Hello? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? What are you just playing music for? Who are you? Talk to me. Talk to me.
This is the Godfather. I'm very upset with you, T.T.
Well, why are you upset with me?
You're playing a party mouse. George Carlin, I heard that nasty talk yesterday on your show. And I won't tolerate that.
Well, I'm sorry if you're offended, Godfather. I'll talk to George. We're having a seance tonight. And when I get in touch with him, I'm going to tell him that he can't put any more potty mouth stuff on my show. How's that?
Well, that's going to work out okay. I was afraid I was going to have to send a couple of guys down from Chicago to the bunker and take care of you. But if you're going to straighten it out with George, I'll let it ride this time, but don't let it happen again.
Okay, Godfather, thanks a lot, and you take care. I sure don't want any trouble with you. I don't want trouble with you, Godfather, all right?
All right.
By the way, Godfather, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. In case you want to send us some money, you know, some of that Las Vegas money, we could use it. So, what do you think?
Well, I'll see what I can do. The feds about clean me out with income taxes. I can't hide them anymore, so I'll try to send you some, okay?
Thank you, Godfather. Okay, we'll talk to you soon. Call in any time. Well, there he goes, the Godfather. Oh, wow, boy, I'm telling you, I didn't know the Godfather listened to my radio show. Worried about that potty mouth stuff by George Carlin yesterday, and I figured I might have offended somebody, but the Godfather, wow. I figured he'd heard all that stuff in Las Vegas, but I guess not. But I don't want to offend him, that's for sure. By the way, the seventh season of Dexter is out, available in the DVD stores. And believe me, it's hot, it's hot. Dexter is a lone wolf personified. And in the first two or three shows of the season, he had a Russian mob guy. I mean, a real sophisticated Russian, and I liked him too. They were adversaries, but almost contemporaries. Dexter and, what was his name? Isaac. Yeah, Isaac. He was cool. Well, here's one I guess they can't blame on me. In Portland, Oregon. They like to hang everything on Terrible Tommy in Portland. Portland, Oregon. Four teenagers are accused of carving a swastika into the forehead of a 16-year-old boy. The Oregonian reports that Jenna Montgomery, 15, that sounds like a girl, Jess Taylor, 17, Blue Kalmbach, 15, and a 14-year-old boy attacked the boy in a shed, shooting him with a BB gun, hitting him with a crowbar on top of carving a swastika into his forehead. Wow. Well, anyhow, I expect the Morris D's to show up here any time now with a subpoena. Anything happens in Portland, blame it on Tommy. I sent you out a story about, I hope you could open it up, about the grizzly bear that ate the guy, the dumb white guy. I may have mentioned this before, but I'm totally opposed to killing these animals. And I added to my comment that I guess stand your ground didn't work out this time. Gee. Unless you figure that the bear felt he was standing his ground, right? Like white men should do. Incidentally, on that story of Portland I talked to you about, someone sent me, one of our associates, and sent me a deal, said, this about your old stomping ground. Well, Portland was never my old stomping ground. In fact, I'd never been to Portland. I'd never been to Portland at all before that trial. Well, just like I said, here's the headline. Hundreds of Syrian refugees arriving in North Jersey. Thousands more expected. That's your State Department. You never voted on that kind of stuff. You never voted on the illegal aliens either. In fact, your vote doesn't mean shit. This is articles written by this Jewish gal. The only Syrians we should be allowing into this country are the Christian Syrians who are being slaughtered en masse by the jihadist forces. Who is vetting these Syrian Muslims? Obama's Muslim Brotherhood picks at the nose. How many of these refugees are battle-hardened jihadists, hostile invaders? Well, what happens in Syria should stay in Syria. Yeah, I mean, if the Christians are going over there and brainwashing all these Islamics to join the Christian church, and the violence breaks out, well, they get what they ask for. They get what they deserve, as far as I'm concerned. It has no reason to bring them over here. Not one reason whatsoever, whether they're Christian, Jews, or Muslims. Leave them there, State Department, or sooner or later, you'll suffer the consequences. Yep. And it says right here in the article that it turns out that the hundreds of those being granted temporary protected status are choosing to go to established Syrian communities like those in North Jersey to be with their people. Gee, I guess some racism's okay. White racism's not okay. Well, I don't know what happened there. Somehow I clipped off my show and going to have to put the rest of the show together with the first part of the show. So anyhow, that's what that's all about. Well, it's Freaky Friday around here. You never know what the hell's going to happen. Maybe the Godfather's put a hex on me here and I don't even know it. Crazy again. Four people were killed and two others critically wounded when a woman opened fire at a Mongol tribal office near the Oregon border in Northern California on Thursday, the police said. A 44-year-old tribal leader identified as Sherry Lash, and I saw her picture. She don't look like a Mongol to me. She looks as white as most of the people I see around here. Also known as Sherry Rhodes, that's nothing like Two Feathers McGuire, was arrested at the Cedarville Rancheria tribal office on charges of murder and attempted murder. A spokesman for the Alturas Police Department said the attack took place during an eviction notice. Oh, involving Lash. Four people were shot and killed after the attacker pulled a gun and went, la, 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 and began systematically shooting individuals in the office. Alturas Police Chief Ken Barnes said two others were shot, one of them possibly wounded with a knife as they tried to escape. Let me out of here. This is like nothing I've ever had to deal with in my 25 years of being with the city of Alturas, Barnes said. The Mongols just went nuts. Two women, aged 19 and 45, two men, aged 30 and 50, died, authorities said. One of the dead men was a tribal leader. You know, I'll bet you if they send the pictures out on all these people, I'll bet you at least half of them were white as you and I are, just like this gal that did the shooting. So, actually, really, a white woman killed four Indians, or four Mongols. Two victims who survived the attack, which took place at 3:30 p.m. Thursday, were airlifted to hospitals in critical condition on a white man's helicopter. How about that? No Indian helicopters there. They don't know how to invent a helicopter. I mean, a Mongol. I don't want to get into practice of calling them Indians. They're not Indians. They don't have a dot on their head. One victim who had been shot at least four or five times and possibly stabbed. Oh, they used a white man's gun. They didn't invent a gun, so they had to borrow a white man's gun. Wait a minute. A white woman parading as a Mongol used a gun invented by the white man, and then the victims being transported to the hospital in a white man's helicopter. How about that? Anyhow, that person who was stabbed was out of surgery and intensive care. The other victim, who was shot once, was recovering from surgery. Lash, of Cedarville, California, was being held at the Modoc County Jail on charges of killing Mongols, attempted murder of Mongols, child Mongols endangerment, and brandishing a weapon against Mongols. She would be moved to an undisclosed facility for her safety, Barnes said, because the Indians are on the warpath. Get that bitch. She ain't even an Indian. La, 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 la. After apparently running out of bullets, the attacker picked up a large kitchen knife and chased one of the victims who had been shot and fled the building. Well, I don't know whether she's an Indian or a Negro. She's really acting out the part. Eventually, an uninjured employee was able to detain the attacker in the parking lot area, he added. Alturas is a remote northeastern California town about 30 miles south of the Oregon border. Around 35 members of the Northern Paiute group of Mongols live on 26 acres at the Cedarville Rancheria, according to its website. The group could not be reached for comment. The tribal office in Alturas, about 20 miles west of Cedarville, is where day-to-day business is conducted and tribal events are held, trying to figure out who in the hell's white and who's a real Mongol. Incidentally, our server has got some new programs we're going to be adding to where you can view a lot of our material on your iPhones and so forth. So hang in there, and it won't be too long. Well, the Orthodox Jews are all upset over there in Israel, I'll tell you, because they have a draft law over there, and they'd been not enforcing it with these ultra-Orthodox Jews. But now Mr. Nitwit's changed his mind. And it shows United Torah Judaism M.K. Meir Perush doing battle during a session of the Special Committee for the Equal Sharing of the Burden. He insists Nitwit gave him his word there won't be criminal charges against Haredi draft dodgers. If I had a dollar for every time Nitwit gave his word and took it back. The Haredi parties in the Knesset are enraged. The Knesset Special Committee on Equal Sharing of the Burden, headed by Jewish Home M.K. Ayelet Shakad, approved criminal sanctions for draft dodgers in the new draft law to take place 2017. Of course, up until now, I guess that these Orthodox, young Orthodox Jews were getting out of the draft. Jewish Home M.K. Moti Jogev opposed criminal sanctions in the committee, and his appeal will be discussed next week. M.K. Shikad abstained from the vote. So anyhow, there you go. I thought Israel was all a bunch of Jews that would get got along wonderful. The only time they really get along is when they're attacked. So, the secret to Jewish solidarity is to be attacked all the time, right? Well, here we go again. The German police arrested three men in their 80s and 90s. And one 120 Thursday on suspicion of accessory to murder, when they were guards at the Auschwitz camp. Three others, all in their 90s, may also be arrested if police uncover enough evidence to warrant putting them on trial. Well, when are we going to put these guys, more guys from IG Farben? Isn't it IG Farben and all the industrialists that made all the war material and all the chemical companies that produce the stuff that they produce? When are those old farts going to be brought up on trial? You know, inquiring minds would like to know. Quote, "This is a major step," said Nazi hunter Ephraim Zuroff at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem. After being told of the arrest, he jumped up in the air and clicked his heel and sang. He was singing Sweet Sue in Yiddish. Given the advanced age of the defendants, every effort should be made to expedite their execution. Thus saith our God, Yahweh. German authorities announced last year they would investigate former guards at Nazi death camps, German death camps. Don't say Nazi. The entire German nation, if anybody's guilty, they're all guilty. At the trial of former Sobibor death camp guard John Demonjek, who died in 2012 while appealing his conviction, the court set a precedent by accepting prosecutors' arguments that death camp guards were accessories to murder. Oh, yeah. And their grandchildren, too. Well, I just want to know when all these old retired people that worked for the war effort there, building arms and so forth, the so-called CEOs of the big German industries over there, and the bankers and so forth, you know, when are they going to be picking them up and trying them? Yeah, because you know where that would lead to, the very top of the German high society. That's what would happen. Yeah. Oh, boy. I guess this is a joke, but I saw a deal on the internet. It said the Muslim clerics finally forbid suicide missions, but only on Mars. Right. Well, it makes sense. You don't want any suicide missions on Mars. You know, now that they're running out of old Germans to to prosecute, I think it's time to start digging up the dead ones and prosecuting them. You know, they got all these dead SS men around buried there in Germany. They could dig them up and start retrying them. Well, shall I say it again? Here we go again. Again, another big flap on the Confederate symbol and flag. Down south, the new design of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans license plate in Georgia now features a large Confederate battle flag. What are they celebrating? What the hell are they celebrating? Southern capitalism and Northern capitalism killed, what, 500,000 men? And they're still, oh, man, I'll tell you, this really dorks me. They even get out, well, I know they go out and march around in the uniforms and celebrate all the killing. Whites against whites. Well, I'll clue you in, boys. The Civil War was not about bettering the white race. Because you don't better the white race by killing 500,000 of them. Yeah, the new Georgia license plate featured a large Confederate battle flag, has ignited a controversy in the state, but its designer thinks the whole thing's overblown. Yeah, and this is a way you keep their mind off the real problems of the workers and the problems with the not having collective bargaining and all that kind of stuff. Keep their mind on this kind of stuff. Republicans, capitalists, corporates, Hollywood movies, keep their mind on all this kind of bullshit while you rob them blind. "What's the big deal?" asked Jack Bridewell, the state commander of the Georgia Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the designer of the specialty plates that benefit his organization. "If I offend anyone, I don't understand why, because we had the emblem there for years." You know, if they wanted to help the Confederate veterans, they would have immediately moved all the Negroes offshore. They had enough men left from the Confederate Army, or even the, I'm sure there would have been half of the Union Army would have volunteered to round them up and take them down to the coast and get them on the ships and take them back. They didn't have any desire to get rid of the Negroes. And you know why? Because they were the major labor source. Not free white men on small farms and in small industry. No. Slaves. That's capitalism. That's predatory capitalism. And just like all of these wars, poor man's fight, rich man's war. And they're still using things like this to inflame the working class against their own interests. Instead of dragging the crooked politicians out from the state houses that are screwing you economically and racially, you'll sweat and worry and argue and fight, and there'll probably be people die over this damn license plate. The conservative right wing keep this stuff going and going and going. Georgia has offered a Sons of the Confederate backed license plate with an image of the Confederate flag since 2003. But a recent change in the state's manufacturing process from embossed images to digital stickers necessitated to redesign. With it came renewed attention and a fresh round of criticism. To display this is reprehensible, a Southern Christian Leadership Conference spokesman Maynard Eaton told the Associated Press. "We don't have license plates saying black power." Well, get them, you dumbass. Cowards. If things would have been done like they should have been done, you wouldn't be even here writing about it. You'd have been in Africa generations ago. Back home in Africa. Out where the Negroes do roam with the lions. And the Confederate flag is an especially charged symbol in the South, representing a legacy of racism, injustice, and oppression to many, while held up as an important emblem of heritage by others. It's an important emblem of Southern capitalism is what it is, not populism, even though who was it fought, most of the people fought the war were working class poor whites. They fought it for the dictators of the banking system. And the Northern troops did the same thing for Northern capitalism, as these people made a fortune, not only off the war, but after the war. 9 states, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, offer Sons of the Confederate license plates featuring a version of the Confederate flag. What good is it? Your cities are full of Negroes. Your governor's mansions are full of Negroes. Your state senate's full of Negroes. You've got 50, 55, 60% blacks in most areas of your states. You lost that war, man. You're not going to get it back by hearkening back to a Confederate license plate or reenacting the Civil War, you dumb bastards. Lock and load! But I would say give the blacks were a commodity. they were a capitalist prize that was used. And then, of course, after the war, it was even better for the capitalists, because then you didn't have to feed Negroes, you didn't have to house Negroes, you didn't have to do any education for Negroes, you just turn them loose. The capitalists rubbed their hands in glee, said, oh, shit, now we really got it made. We don't have to take care of them, but we'll use them. And we'll use them to break white labor in the North. And then it won't be too long till we'll figure out another war. Maybe we'll call it the First World War. And we'll send thousands of white Southerners and Northerners off to Flanders to die. Oh, yeah, you're continually led by the nose by these bastards. Led by the nose, and you just keep doing the same thing over and over. And the Negroes keep breeding and breeding and breeding and breeding. Now the Mexicans, mestizos, they're coming in breeding, 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 breeding. You can wave all the damn stars and bars you want. It won't change that a bit. A flag never won a war. You realize that? A flag never won a war. Neither did the army bands win a war. It was guns, bombs, blood, sweat, and tears. Well, you never win a war, really. But anyhow, you overcome the opposition. The northern ruling class overcame the southern ruling class. And the Negro, he lost his guaranteed annual income, his guaranteed job, his guaranteed hovel, his shack, his garden, and everything, and was let loose on the highways to survive as best he could. And then be used as time went on against the white workers of both North and South as they are today. So take your Confederate flags and ram them, boys, because you don't understand what the hell's going on. Or if you do, you're too cowardly to do anything about it. Because if you do anything, you'll just simply chew around the edges of the carpet. You'll chop off a tentacle or two on the octopus, but you don't have the balls to go for the ruling class. You don't have the balls to go into the streets after the ruling class. The rich just sit back and laugh. Do you know what the ruling class do in their private meetings? Their really private meetings? Do you know what they do? Let's hear what they do.
Gotta begin this time, didn't it? We fucked that working class. Drink to that, boys.
You want to know who that was laughing at you? It was the heads of the Democrat Party. It was the heads of the Republican Party. It was the heads of the neocons. It was the heads of the progressives. The heads of the capitalists. Heads of the Negroes. Heads of the Mexicans. Mestizos. Heads of the churches. They're all laughing at you, white man and woman. And you're arguing over a damn symbol on a license plate while everything's going to hell. And you haven't woken up yet. You haven't woken up yet, and they're still laughing. And they should be laughing, because we're such fools. We haven't drug them out of their high places and hung them We haven't even got a guillotine built to chop their heads off. Most of you don't even have pitchforks or a torch or maybe even a sword. But you'll argue about every other thing in the world but what needs to be not be argued. That we're being screwed by the 1%. And the only way you're going to change it is for the 1% on our side to screw them. Forget all this other stuff. All this other stuff is just plain bullshit. And don't let me forget all the Jews laughing and the Israelis laughing and all the countries that are receiving foreign aid from you, dumb worker. Well, I'll tell you what, I think it's time to check back in and see if they're still laughing. What do you think? Okay. Whoa!
Keep on paying those taxes, boys. Keep on playing, watching the niggerball games. Keep on going to the churches and all that kind of crap. Keep on. We love that shit. It's great. It's great. You're doing real good. We're getting richer and richer, and you're getting fucked.
For that little southern capitalist symbol there, baby. You put that on your car and it's all gonna go away. Nobody gonna laugh at you at all. Maybe put a little bigger one on your car. Paint it on the top of your pickup. That'll fix everything. Yeah, right. You know, I think I'll end up every show with that little sneaking in and listening through the crack in the door of the ruling class for you and see what they think about you. I should do that after every show. Well, let's hear what that Jim way up in the tower has to say today.
Attention class, today's word is fractal inequality.
Okay, that's a phrase, not a word, and a very wonky one. It means uneven inequality, but the unevenness refers not to the relatively poor, but to the relatively super rich, the one percenters versus the 1/10 and 1/100 of one percenters. The 1% averages an income of about $1 million a year, while the 1/100 clique tops $30 million. Wow, how do you even spend 30 big ones a year? Your penthouse, Lamborghini, dinner every night at Le Petit Fortune, etc., still leaves some $20 million for you to play with. Luckily, the New York Times has answered this question for us commoners in a recent article headlined, Wealthiest Americans Go House Hunting Abroad. It seems that there are bargains to be had on old castles in the Irish countryside, so many super-rich Americans are buying a piece of the old sod for themselves. Parisian townhouses and wine country chateaus are always in vogue, so why not have one or two? But the big action for American swells is in the Caribbean, where a five-bedroom villa on St. Bart's, for example, can sop up $14 million of your spare cash. The article tells us, however, that the latest trend is not simply to buy a fabulous house overlooking the pink sand beaches of some resort island, but to buy your very own Caribbean island. What cachet! One popular possibility is the Exuma Cays, a cluster of 360 islands in the Bahamas. For instance, here's one 47-acre island with a 3,000-foot airstrip and seven white sand beaches that can be had for just over $15 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, as an online dealer in private islands notes, buying one is about the majestic image it bestows on the buyer. They want to be steward of their own little piece of the world, he marveled.
Well, did you ever ask yourself this? Why do maps always show north as up? Yeah, for those who don't just take it for granted, the common answer is that European white people made the maps, and they wanted to be on top. but there's really no good reason for the North to claim top-notch cartography real estate over any other bearing, as an examination of old maps from the different places and periods can confirm. Yes, there is. By right of conquest, they decided. The profound arbitrariness of our current cartographic conventions was made evident by MacArthur's universal corrective map of the world, an iconic upside-down view of the world that recently celebrated its 35th anniversary, launched by Australian Stuart MacArthur on January the 26th, 1979, on Australia Day. This map is supposed to challenge our casual acceptance of the European perspectives as global norms, but seen today with the title Australia no longer down under. It's hard not to wonder why the upside-down map, for all its subversiveness, wasn't called Botswana, back where it belongs, or perhaps Paraguay Paramount. Yeah, let's see here. We got some more of this story here. This is getting exciting. Whoop, I went too far. Hold on, hold it, hold it. Let's see here. The MacArthur map also makes us wonder, why we're so quick to assume that Northern Europeans were the ones who invented the modern map and decided which way to hold it. In the first place, as is so often the case, our eagerness to invoke Eurocentrism displays a certain bias of its own. Of course, everybody's biased, since in fact the Norse elite cartographic status owes more to Byzantine monks and Majorcan Jews than it does to any Englishman, you see? I knew they'd get around to that. Either the blacks invented it, or the Jews invented it, or some, and those dirty Northern Europeans. There's nothing inevitable or intrinsically correct, not in geographic or cartographic or even philosophical terms, about the North being represented as up, because up on a map is a human construction, not a natural one. Some of the very earliest Egyptian maps show the South as up, presumably equating the Nile's northward flow with the force of gravity. And there was a long stretch of medieval era when most European maps were drawn from the east on the top. If there was any doubt about this move's religious significance, they eliminated it with their maps' pious illustrations, whether Adam and Eve or Christ enthroned. In the same period, Arab map makers often drew maps with the south facing up, possibly because this is how the Chinese did it. Things changed with the age of exploration, like the Renaissance. This era didn't start in Northern Europe. It began in the Mediterranean, somewhere between Europe and the Arab world, allegedly by this article. In the 14th and 15th centuries, increasingly precise navigational maps of the Mediterranean Sea in many ports called Portolan charts appeared. They were designed for use by mariners navigating the sea's trade routes with the help of the recently adopted technology, the compass. These maps had... Who invented the compass, though? We should go back there. I think we would have to talk about the Vikings and their lodestone. Maybe the White Greeks or someone like that also. These maps had no real up or down. Pictures and words faced in all sorts of directions, generally pointing inward from the edge of the map, but they all included a compass, rose with north clearly distinguished from the other directions. There you go. Members of the Italian cartographic school preferred to mark north with a hat or embellished arrow, while their equally influential colleagues from the Spanish-ruled island of Majorca, used an elaborate rendering of Polaris, the North Star. These men who formed the Majorcan cartographic school also established a number of other crucial mapping conventions of the area, including coloring in the Red Sea bright red and drawing the Alps as a giant chicken foot, among other hints of the school's predominantly Jewish membership, was the nickname of one of its more prominent members, the Compass Jew. That's interesting there. But this is only part of the explanation. The arrow of the compass can just as easily point south, since the magnetized metal needle simply aligns with the Earth's magnetic field, with a pole at each end. Indeed, the Chinese supposedly referred to their first compass magnets as south-pointing stones. Crucially, the Chinese developed this convention before they began to use compasses for navigation at sea. By the time the Europeans adopted the compass, though, they were already experienced in navigating, with the reference to the North Star, the one point in the heavens that remains fixed anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. Many mariners saw the compass as an artificial replacement for the star on cloudy nights, and even assumed it was the pull of the star itself that drew the needle north. Well, I think that a lot of this was with the Nordics and the Vikings with that lodestone situation. They had a compass type object in their big open longboats, and possibly they even gave the idea to the Chinese too. Of course, no one wants to give whites credit anymore for anything. Yet even this north-pointing compass became essential to navigation and navigational charts in the 15th century. Less precise land maps showed the entire known old world continued to offer a disorienting array of perspectives. Some had the east on the top, in keeping with European tradition, while others preferred the south, in keeping with the Arab tradition, and others went with the north, in keeping the point on the compass, in keeping with the point on the compass rose. Among other things that stand out in these maps is that, given the extent of the known world, the location of the Mediterranean, and a bit of uncertainty about the equator, Italy was more or less centered between the north and the south, meaning that whichever way you turned the map, Italy remained more or less halfway between the north and the top, bottom. Conveniently, Italy was a roughly the same latitude as Jerusalem, which, though most of the century map makers assumed was at the center of the known world. In fact, the first blow to this pious assumption came with the discovery of just how much the old world lies to the east of Jerusalem. Only later did it become apparent just how far north of the equator Jerusalem, and by extension Italy, really was. Well, that's enough of that funny stuff for today. I thought you might be a little bit interested in that, but I'll tell you what, this map, this Australian map, is very interesting to look at. And this MacArthur's Universal Corrective Map of the World, upside down, it really gives you a total different view of the continents of the Earth. It's very quite interesting. And it shows how large Europe and Eastern Europe and Asiatic Russia and all that kind of stuff is compared to the United States in size. Of course, we knew that it was much bigger. But just think, if Uncle Adolf would have peacefully made a deal with the Russians and they had become a giant federation without a big war, guess who would be in control? And I assume you would be speaking German. Oh, boy. And I guess that's why a lot of people refer to the Russian, giant Russian lands as the prize. Well, has San Francisco declared war on the homeless? At 4:30 a.m., wake-up call for some San Francisco's homeless comes by the way of a massive hose spraying water into the sidewalks from a Department of Public Works vehicle. City officials call it a pilot program to keep the streets tidy and wash away the homeless. No, but, but homeless advocates say it's part of an orchestrated plan by the city to cater to tech workers. And then the city comes back and says, we don't point water at homeless people. Well, that isn't a bad way to keep the place clean, but homeless people got to have some kind of break. What's this? A Supreme Court justice speaking the truth? Japanese Americans are holding a day of remembrance this week for community elders who were unlawfully locked in the internment camps during World War II. Well, they should be holding remembrances of Nagasaki and Hiroshima is what they should be doing. But for many people, including U.S. judicial authorities, the specter of the camps is hardly a thing of the past. Quote, you are kidding yourself if you think the same thing will not happen again, unquote, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia told the University of Hawaii law students earlier this month. In times of war, the laws fall silent. And that's going to go next time for you, white boy. For many former detainees who will tell their stories during the remembrance events on Wednesday, that was last Wednesday, Scala's words are a sobering reminder that national security at times trumps constitutional rights. They think of the National Security Agency's mass surveillance of private communications or the indefinite detentions of alleged terrorism suspects, mostly Arab and Muslim so far, under the National Defense Authorization Act. Nothing ever changes. Nothing changes. The Day of Remembrance marks not only the day in 1942 when President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order allowing the internment of 120,000 people of Japanese origin after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. It also serves as a reminder to our communities. Our civil rights are still not protected, said Karen Korematsu, whose father, Fred Korematsu, famously challenged his detention in the landmark Supreme Court case Korematsu versus the United States in 1944. Karen Korematsu cited the NDAA's indefinite detentions as one attack on civil rights, which there is none. Forget rights. Now faced primarily by American Muslims. That's a oxymoron, an American Muslim. Among the other issues that they say they face are the mass infiltration of mosque communities by law enforcement and harassment by Transportation Security Administration staff at the U.S. borders. They want to all come in. Don't stop us. Quote, even Scalia said this could happen again. That's why education is so important. Well, anyhow, that's showbiz. That's the showbiz there. Well, there were plenty of Germans that were put in camps, plenty of Italians put in camps too. Even though I like Japanese people in general and I enjoyed visits to Japan, I think it would have been better off for everybody if we had not let the Japanese come in or the Chinese come in for cheap labor. Remember that, Chinese brought in for cheap labor. And if it wasn't for our real workers champion in California, and his name escapes me right now, that started giving fiery speeches about keeping these Chinese out. He said to the big shots, the 1%, the ruling class, if you don't get them out of here, if you don't keep them out, we're going to be bombing your houses up there in the high-class neighborhoods where you live. And that became the working man's party, and then they did adopt the exclusionary rules. But white people never keep on following through. They get soft. Oh, it's cheap labor. No, he's a nice guy. Well, he wants to be a Christian or some other stupid reason for leaving him here. Problem is, most other countries don't operate that way. They don't. It's been my experience in the Japanese people that I knew that took me to Japan and took John to Japan that they don't really respect these American Japanese Americans. They don't see them as real Japanese. I notice now that we've got Al Jazeera America, they've turned into just another lefty progressive type channel. That all they do is talk about how horrible it is for blacks and Japanese and American Indians and mestizos. And of course, indirectly, it's an attack on the white race. Well, let's close out the show with a briefing on what's going on in South Africa for white people.
Briefing.
White flight from South Africa. Between staying and going, violent crime and political turmoil are adding to South Africa's brain drain.
First he thought it was a mouse, then a rat, and then the rat shot him in the face. That is how André Brink, one of South Africa's most famous novelists, described the recent killing of his nephew, Adrie, at home at 3 a.m. in the morning. The young man was left to die on the floor, in front of his wife and daughter, while his killers ransacked the house. Such murders are common in South Africa. According to Mr. Brink's account, published later in the Sunday Independent, 16 armed attacks had already taken place in a single month within a kilometre of the young couple's plot north of Pretoria, South Africa's capital. Soon afterwards, this is more unusual, the police arrested a gang of six. They recovered a laptop and two mobile phones. That was the haul for which Adrie paid with his life. A decade and a half after the end of apartheid, violent crime is pushing more and more whites out of South Africa. Exactly how many are leaving is impossible to say. Few admit that they are quitting for good, and the government does not collect the necessary statistics. But large white South African diasporas, both English and Afrikaans-speaking, have sprouted in Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and many cities of North America. The South African Institute of Race Relations, a think tank, guesses that 800,000 or more whites have emigrated since 1995, out of the 4 million plus who were there when apartheid formally ended the year before. Robert Crawford, a research fellow at King's College in London, reckons that around 550,000 South Africans live in Britain alone. Not all of South Africa's emigres are white. Skilled blacks from South Africa can be found in jobs and places as various as banking in New York and nursing in the Persian Gulf. But most are white, and thanks to the legacy of apartheid, the remaining whites, though only about 9% of the population, are still South Africa's richest and best-trained people. Talk about white flight does not go down well. Officials are quick to claim that there is nothing white about it. A recent survey by FutureFact, a polling organisation, found that the desire to emigrate is pretty even across races. Last year, 42% of coloured, mixed-race South Africans, 38% of blacks, and 30% of those of Indian descent were thinking of leaving, compared with 41% of whites. This is a big leap from 2000, when the numbers were 12%, 18%, 26%, and 22% respectively. But it is the whites, by and large, who have the money, skills, contacts, and sometimes passports they need to start a life outside, and who leave the bigger skills and tax gap behind. Another line loyalists take is that South Africa is no different from elsewhere. In a global economy, skills are portable. One benefit of our new democracy is that we are well integrated in the community of nations, so now more opportunities are accessible to our people. Kgalema Motlanthe, now South Africa's president, told The Economist. And to some extent it is true that the doctors, dentists, nurses, accountants and engineers who leave are being pulled by bigger salaries, not pushed by despair. But this is not the whole story. Nick Holland, chief executive of Goldfields, a mining company, says that in his firm it is far commoner for skilled whites to leave than their black and Indian counterparts. We mustn't stick our heads in the sand, he says. White flight is a reality. Another claim is that a lot of leavers return. Martine Scheffer, a Durbanite, who returned to South Africa herself in 2003 after 14 years in London, now runs the Homecoming Revolution, an outfit created with help from the First National Bank to tempt lost sheep back to the fold. And yes, a significant number of émigrés do come home, seduced by memories of the easeful poolside life under the jacaranda trees, excited by work opportunities or keen, perhaps after having children themselves, to reunite with parents who stayed behind. In some cases, idealism remains a draw. Whites who left in previous decades because they were repelled by apartheid, or who expected apartheid to end in a bloodbath, can find much to admire. Whites build tall walls round their houses and pay guards to patrol their neighbourhoods. They consider some downtown areas too dangerous to visit. But on university campuses and in the bright suburban shopping malls, it is still thrilling to see blacks and whites mingling in a relaxed way that was unimaginable under apartheid. So South Africa certainly has its white boosters. Michael Katz, chairman of Edward Nathan Sonnenberg's, a law firm in Johannesburg, hands over a book with the title Don't Panic, a collection of heartwarming reflections by disparate South Africans on why there is, even now, no better place than home. Mr. Katz ticks off the pluses as he sees them. Minimal racial tension. Third of his own firm's 350 professionals are black. A model constitution that entrenches the separation of powers and is revered by the people. A free press and free judiciary. A healthy parliament. A vibrant civil society. Good infrastructure and a banking system untouched by the global credit crunch.
Well, I'm shutting that down because it's ruling class 1% propaganda. If you've been around as long as I have, you can smell it. And you notice how they don't describe the killers in the early part of that tape. They come into the house and kill a guy for a couple of damn, tape recorder and a Wi-Fi. Those were Kaffirs, sir. Kaffirs. Otherwise known as niggers. The same way they act up here, many of them. So, don't give me that ruling class bullshit about how wonderful it is. Because it's not wonderful, but you're trying to somehow eke out the most amount of profits no matter how you have to go about it. Why don't we just start calling the media the ruling class press? Because there is very little in the papers or TV or anything that goes against the grain anymore. And of course, none of our spokesmen could get on radio and TV. I mean, that's your first clue, that no matter how articulate or how intellectual people who agree and we agree with them are, they cannot get on TV, they cannot buy time to have a program on TV, and they're just stuck in the internet, which is good, but it's not as good. Even a lot of the more radical progressives complain about that it's very difficult for them to get into many markets that are totally, absolutely, totally controlled by the neocon corporates. And so that's just the way it is. What are they afraid of?
What are they afraid of?
They're afraid of Terrible Tommy's guillotine that I'm going to get no matter what. I've been going to get it for 2 years, and I'm still going to get it. One of our people had been pointing out to me this Sikh and Indian infiltration into this country and into the halls of the leadership. This Nimrata Niki Ranhawa is the governor now of South Carolina, the heart of the Confederacy. She was born on January 20th, 1972, to an Indian Sikh family. Her parents, A.J. Singh and Raham Wawawanga and Raj Wawawanga, are immigrants from the Amritsar district of Punjab, India. Now, born in 72, and she's already governor. The ruling class take care of people who play the game, who allow themselves to be mounted and raped. They'll reward you. She has two brothers, Mitty and Charan, and a sister, Simran. Haley is a graduate of Orangeburg Preparatory Schools and Clemens University with a B.S. in accounting. Well, I'm not going to go any farther. A Sikh being the governor of a state, we're going from worse to better or bad to worse or whatever. Negroes running the cities around the country, governors, the president. Indians are coming on strong. In fact, a couple of days ago, there were arrests of about four of these Sikhs within about 25 miles of me for narcotics distribution. Sikhs in Indiana. Jeez. There's probably thousands of them here, and I just don't know about it. Well, that's the state of the situation. South Carolina, the big center of the Confederacy. Do you think they were really concerned about ridding South Carolina of the Negroes? There's certainly plenty of them there. And now you've got the Mexicans and the Sikhs and the Hindus and all of them. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's going to be... Boy, you're going to be bequeathing a wonderful nation to your kids. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for them. But if they're brought up in this swill, they're going to think, well, this must be the way it always was, no matter how many old movies they watch. That's the thing. You think that people are going to get all upset, but the younger generation that are brought up in this crap, get used to it and say, oh, these are the good old days. These are the good old days. I'm out of here. I'll be back tomorrow on Saturn's Day and see if I can't offend some more people. 14-5. That was Floyd Kramer, for the good times. A great, great piano player. Goes out to the She-Wolves on Freya's Day.